Good afternoon. The time is 1:32, and I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We are in Belts, room 105, the Thomas Stewart Building in the beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Wednesday, February 14th, 2024. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. Members present today are Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjork. Senators Merrick and Bishop are away in Finance Committee this afternoon. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I would like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Lisa Denny, and our LAO moderator, Shelby Carroll. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. We have a few items on our agenda today. First up is going to be Senate Bill 147, Reemployment Benefits. That will be followed by Senate Bill 206, Workers' Compensation Stay-at-Work Program. And finally, Senate Bill 135, Alaska Work and Save Program, Retirement Savings. First up today is Senate Bill 147. To present this bill, we have its sponsor, Senator James Kaufman, and his staff, Dominic Harnett. Gentlemen, please join us at the table and welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you very much. For the record, Senator James Kaufman, State District F, Anchorage. And I would like to thank the chair and the committee for hearing this bill today. Certainly appreciate it. So, Will, I'll give a kind of a brief overview and then defer to my staff, Dominic Harnett, who kind of get into more of the details. At its heart, SB 147, Reemployment Benefits, seeks to address some of the shortcomings in Alaska's workers' compensation system. Alaska can be a tough place to work. Injuries do occur. It's important that we as a state have a reliable and predictable compensation program that gets people back to work while taking care of them while they're down. Alaska's current system is not working. In recent years, an average of 140 out of 550 evaluations performed each year were found eligible for current system's rehabilitation plan, yet only an average of 13 workers, that's 1/3 workers, fully finished the plan. SB 147 improves the workers' compensation system by fixing unnecessary administrative burdens and clarifying the role of stakeholders in the process. SB 147 also updates the reemployment plan costs to adjust for inflation. An amount currently set in statute was set in the year 2000 and has not been adjusted since. Time for an update. The primary objective of this legislation is to ensure that injured workers receive swift and fair access to indemnity and medical benefits while also promoting efficient return to work programs. By updating the system to better align with modern realities, we can reduce the economic burden of workplace injuries and illnesses on Alaskans, improve employment retention, and get more Alaskans back to work in our communities. So again, I thank the committee and the chair for your consideration. And if you prefer, my staff is now ready to go through the sectional. That's the will of the committee.
That would be most excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. For the record, Dominic Harnett, staff to Senator Kaufman. So the sectional analysis for SB 147, this is Bill Version A. Section 1, this would amend Alaska Statute 2330.041, subsection B, to change the required date of submittal of a report of reemployment benefits for the previous calendar year. The original date was May 1st. This will be changed to October 1st. This is to better align it with some other deadlines. Section 2, this adds language to Alaska Statute 2330.041, subsection C, stating that the administrator may order an eligibility evaluation if the employee is totally unable to return to the employee's employment for 90 consecutive days as a result of the injury. Currently, these are required without regard for any evaluation, whether an evaluation is warranted at that time. This would also, section 2 would also increase the 90-day mandatory reemployment evaluation to 120 days. This is to allow for more time for medical stability of claimants. And next section, section 3, this increases eligibility evaluation time from 30 days to 60 days. This built-in 30-day extension allows the division to remove language granting the administrator authority to provide a 30-day extension for the eligibility evaluation. which removes excessive reviews and extra unnecessary work for the administrator. It also adds some clarifying language, such as use of the word it by referring directly to the hearing. Section 4 adds reference to include training and employment services offered by the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Section 5 makes changes to Alaska Statute 2330-041, subsection J. A reemployment plan must ensure remunerative employability. And some technical changes are also made. Section 6 increases the benefit under Alaska Statute 2330-041, subsection L, from $13,300 to $22,150, and allows their department to adjust the cost for inflation through regulation. Section 7 includes changes to Alaska Statute 3925-158, subsection B, to prioritize returning an employee to their former position rather than focusing on retraining an employee for another employment opportunity. Section 8 ensures that a relevant professional, a physician, certifies that the employee is able to perform the task assigned in their former position. The last section, Section 9, this section specifies the applicability of the amendments in Section 7 and 8 to contracts or collective bargaining agreements that become legally binding on or after the effective dates of these amendments. This act is aimed at regulating and improving the reemployment benefits and rights of injured employees in the state of Alaska, with a focus on rehabilitation plans and the responsibilities of the administrator. That includes the sectional for Senate Bill 147. Happy for you to answer any questions.
Very good. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Dunbar.
Can you explain a little bit more about, in Section 8, why switch to a physician rather than this kind of administrator? And also, are there any other kind of medical providers other than physicians that could do it? You know, I don't know, a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, or is there anyone else other than a physician that might be able to sign off on this?
Thank you. Due to the technical nature of some of these questions, we may want to defer the question to Director Collins.
Very good. And I'll let him take that up when he provides in some invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Further questions? Okay. If you'd like to begin your presentation.
Thank you, through the chair. I understand that Director Collins is here, and he will bring us through the presentation.
Oh, very good. Excellent. Well, Director Collins, please come to the table and begin your presentation.
For the record, Director Charles Collins, Workers' Compensation, Department of Labor, and happy Valentine's Day to all of you. Before I begin here, I want to give personal thanks to Senator Kaufman for picking up this much-needed bill and changes to Statute 2330-041 for the division. As you may or may not know, there's been resolutions from 2017 and 2021 from the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board asking for changes to this program because of some shortfalls in our process, which hold back Alaska, especially injured workers, from reentering the workplace. We are asking an impossible task of not only staff at the division, but also those contractors that we work with, specifically rehabilitation specialists, in doing the job that they would dearly love to be able to do properly and have been limited severely by changes due to economics. We haven't had changes in this bill since 2005, and specific parts of it since the year 2000. So with that, let me just explain why we got to where we are. So SB 147 is before you today, and One of the things that is shared every year at our annual board meeting, so all in my division, we update our board. It's an 18-member board, 9 from the industry side, 9 from the labor side, and we update on all facets of what has happened in workers' compensation. And the reason we do this is because we are a very hands-on working board there, and we have great impact on people's lives. So employers with injured employees are impacted financially. Those employees, of course, are impacted both financially, physically, and sometimes mentally. And many times, some of those injured would end up being out of work for a considerable amount of time. Alaska is a great place to live and a great place to work, but some of that work can be inherently dangerous. People get hurt badly and can be out of work for an extended period of time. And so in the law, in 2330.041, there was built in there, if an injured worker is out of work 90 days without being able to return to work, they must, and the word is shall in 041, have an evaluation done by a private entity called a rehabilitation specialist. And you can see on the far left how many of those were done. So in 2022, we had 488, for example. And of those that shall have that evaluation, only 67 were actually found eligible. And the reasons for this are manifold, but some of them, approximately half a dozen, a quarter or so, just depends on chance a little bit, might already be back at work by 90 days. But the law says they shall be done. And so we have several instances where people have actually been back to work and it's at the job that they had and had to go in and get an evaluation, which costs that employer about $3,000 on average just for that evaluation. Some of those injured workers, conversely, are still going through the medical process and it's not timely yet for them to have an evaluation, but yet we still have to do it because statute rules here. And the goal of the board and with the help of Senator Kaufman was to change 2330.041 so that we wouldn't have to have that evaluation until it was timely. Thus, we want to extend it from 90 days out to 120, but allow the RBA, she's online, her name is Stacy Niwa, you know, to use her expertise. She has a master's degree in this field and allow her to use her ability to decide whether or not it is timely up until that 120 day, which is at that point we feel the cutoff. We must do something. And so we're not extending people out from getting this evaluation. We're just allowing those that would not need it for already going back to work or for not yet being timely be decided. And we have an expert in the field that can look at that situation, speak to the medical professionals and decide whether or not, 90 days or 60 days even, it is timely. You will also see on that same graph, without going forward, that even though we might have 67 on there, we have some that fall off, and some of that is dislocation, job dislocation agreement between the injured worker and the employer, and sometimes this works out for both parties instead of going through a long recuperation and trying to get back to that job or maybe some retraining or something. They decide to take the money and do the training on themselves, or they might be moving out of state, their job. We allow the employee to have that choice, and that's set in 2330.041. We're not talking about that part whatsoever in here, but that is a portion of the fallout. And then when we get all the way to the far side, those are the plans that are completed. And as Senator Kaufman so aptly put it, we get very few through there. He was being generous at saying 13. Some years we get 5 or 6 that have made it through the plan. They have 2 years from the time of the evaluation, and the plan is okay to get through the plan, but they're limited to $13,300. Now, just in case you haven't had to pay tuition at your favorite college or enrolled somewhere in a, you know, even an online training, $13,300 is not a lot of money to retrain somebody that may have been in the heavy industry, may have been a roofer, may have been a truck driver that is no longer able to do that kind of work. And now they're going to find something that they both want to do and can do and be retrained for it. $13,300 is not enough. And it hasn't been changed for 24 years now. So SB 147 adjusts that. And so you see, I put a slide in here that talks about the evaluation costs. We have about 1.4 or 5 million just in the evaluation costs every year. And as I said, some of those are untimely. A number of those are untimely. We feel like we can save employers some money on that side. Granted, we're going to kind of take that money that we're saving, and it will cost them a little money more for the retraining plan. But the outcome for the state of Alaska is those workers are back into the workforce, growing our GDP and growing our economy. And so think about these workers that have been out there, that have been injured, have been sitting on the sideline, that have no choice. And statistics show if they're out of work today, I was sent one today from a study in the Northeast where they said that any worker that was out of work 1 year has an 11% chance of ever returning to the workforce. So if they're out of work for a year, they may never get back. And there's a lot of things in there that can come and play, but you guys probably have at some point in your career been in charge of hiring somebody. When you look at somebody's resume and you see a big gap in their employment, you're always concerned about what was that gap. And if it's an injury, it can be fairly easily, you know, explained, but it lowers their marketability in the job place. So we're hoping to move this process along by not only moving the date. It sounds counterintuitive, but moving from 90 to 120 days would seem to be worse. But the point is that we're allowing that position that the state already pays for, the latter ability to actually use their expertise to make this work. And then secondly, the reporting goes from 30 days to 60 days, but in actuality, it's averaging 45 or 46 days now because of the way the evaluations are done. They're not timely, so the rehabilitation specialist is calling the doctor, and the doctor is not answering those questions because they're not ready to answer those questions. They can't make that medical opinion yet, so they have to wait and call back in 2 weeks to find out if there's something. And so that extends it out. If we move those evaluations and we move that reporting out to, you know, so they have 60 days to put that together, we think we can move things faster, believe it or not. So, one of the other additions in here that we really are excited about is when 2330-041 was first crafted, there was not one mention in there about helping people to learn how to actually apply and interview for a job. And one of the things we wanted to do is to write it in there that the services of the Department of Labor, which come to those searching for work for free, would be part of a plan for anybody that is being retrained so that they don't necessarily have to go to the Department of Labor to search for a job, although we certainly would like them to do it, but they would go for coaching for interviews and assistance with writing resumes. And both of those in this day and age are extremely important for people that are looking for jobs. And then when we move to the new amount and people go out and get their retraining and come back and get some assistance with doing that, we have a very high confidence level in them being able to secure employment and get our participation rate up in this. And so with that, I would be glad to answer any question, and I will start with Senator Dunbar's, if it's okay with the chair.
Yes, so please.
I don't, through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I'm not qualified to say whether or not other medical professionals can make that determination. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say they probably are. However, you'll look at that statute, and that statute applies to the state of Alaska workers only, I believe. And, you know, I will defer to the risk management department on that. So.
Roger, thank you, Mr. Director, for that answer. Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just sort of reiterate then the necessity of Section 8. So you've got this benefits administrator or director of vocational rehabilitation. Presumably they could seek a medical opinion of any number of medical providers to make their determination. Now we're sort of removing them and saying a physician specifically, and sort of any physician, right? So I can you just sort of describe why we need Section 8?
I will have to get back to you that through the chair, Senator Dunbar. I will have to defer to that. I don't have an answer for Section 8. I unfortunately did not spend a lot of time on the portion that I have no control over that portion whatsoever. Thus, it's outside of my expertise, basically. That's risk management. So
do we have, Mr. Chair, do we have anyone else to speak to this bill?
We have the Reemployment Benefits Administrator, Stacy Niwa, online. And Stacy, anytime if you're available, you want to answer a question. I'm not sure if you can unmute yourself to answer a question if you feel like you can. That would be most welcome.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me?
We can, ma'am. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. This is Stacy Niwa. I'm the Reemployment Benefits Administrator for State of Alaska Workers' Compensation. Through the chair, thank you. Senator Dunbar, I think you have a great question. I agree with Director Collins. That section of the statute deals directly with State of Alaska employees, and it is through risk management. Currently, the way that it is written does allow for that determination to be made either by myself or the director of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. Both positions have experience with disability and how that impacts or could potentially impact work. This change, I do think, would need to be vetted through risk management to just better understand. Currently, yes, there are two other individuals that are able to make this decision currently with the way the statute is written.
Can I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Indeed.
And this might be the sponsor of the bill. So I guess I'm a little curious sort of where this section came from, because I thought it was coming from your office, Ms. Niwa. And I sort of understand, I'm thinking about this in the military context. Sometimes it's too specific. Only one person can do a job. And it becomes problematic if it's a general officer, for example. So you want to delegate or expand the number of people that can sign off on something. And so I guess I'm trying to understand why we'd want to remove these two people rather than expand it. Maybe you could say these two people could do it or a physician could do it. You know, so we, because I think that's the goal here. I asked the sponsor of the bill. I mean, the goal here is because there's something about physicians that we need them specifically, or are we trying to kind of expand the number of people that can make this determination?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, again, I believe that this, as this bill was assembled, that there was risk management elements in it. And what we'll have to do is take a look at that and get back and be sure that that's on track. And if there's some amendment to that that needs to be made, that's fine. But again, as you know, these technical bills like this, you're acquiring details from the department. So we'll take a look at that and make sure that that's on track.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Kaufman.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to make a comment relative to Senator Dunbar's question. To me, this makes sense. And the reason why it makes sense is because if you know, we're talking about injured employees. If you get injured, you're going to go to the doctor. So to me, it makes sense to have a physician determine whether or not you're able to go back to work. So this amendment is real clear to me. I'm not just speaking for myself. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
May I respond?
You're welcome. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Jackson, I appreciate those comments. In saying risk management, again, that's, you know, from the state's perspective, that's what it is. From the employee's perspective, it's a health matter. You know, an employment matter, but I think it's just an attempt to be careful with how we do these evaluations. But we will double check. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Ms. Niwa, thank you for being available for questions today. If you have further testimony or presentation on this bill that you would like to present to the committee, we would love to hear that now.
Thank you. I don't have anything further to share.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for being available. I have a question. The difference between 90 days and 120 days is obviously 30. Is that enough flexibility for you? Does it need to be a longer period of time so that you're able to assess a situation and not have to implement an evaluation that isn't needed or ripe yet? Is that enough time?
I do feel that it's enough time. Currently, 90 days, there's enough time even, I think, currently at times, just because we do receive copies of medical documentation on the injured worker's case. We have information to review. If we have an additional 30 days to make that decision, it just gives us a little more room to ensure we're making the right decision on the behalf of the injured worker and the employer. I think more time than that, then we are not following the intent of this statute, which is fast, fair, and efficient delivery of benefits. So I do feel that the 120 days makes sense.
Very good. Thank you. Further questions for Ms. Niwa, Director Collins, or the bill sponsor? Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a couple comments. First, I'd like to thank Senator Kaufman for bringing this much-needed bill forward. And then I'd like to look to Charles, Mr. Collins, and just thank you and all of your staff for the job you do on behalf of our injured employees. And I can always tell when somebody really likes their job. I really can. And obviously, to me, you and your staff fall into that category. So thank you. Your work is much appreciated. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. At this time, we will open up public testimony on Senate Bill 147. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify to Senate Bill 147? Is there anyone online who wishes to testify? Seeing and hearing no one else wishing to testify on the bill, we'll hold public testimony open and set this bill aside for further consideration. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for our next bill. And we're back on the record, 2:02 p.m. here in Belch Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building. We're going to get back to work with Senate Bill 206, Workers' Compensation Stay at Work Program. The sponsor, Senator Elvy Gray Jackson, and her staff, Luma Diaz, are here to present the bill. Senator, please put your stamp on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Elvy Gray Jackson, representing District G in Anchorage. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for hearing my bill this afternoon. In June 2023, Senator Workman and I attended a forum sponsored by the Council of State Governments and the United States Department of Labor State Exchange on Employment and Disabilities, also known as SEED, which addressed stay-at-work, return-to-work programs throughout the country. We joined attendees from Kansas, Kentucky, Massachusetts, and Minnesota, in addition to staff from the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Also in attendance was the Deputy Assistant Secretary, Jennifer Sheehy, from the United States Department of Labor, Office of Disability Employment Policy, among other prominent speakers. SEED and its partners assist states and localities interested in developing and implementing inclusive workforce development policies. We learned about the benefits of stay-at-work, return-to-work policies and programs, which included interacting with subject matter experts to learn strategies for better designing, implementing, and evaluating stay-at-work, return-to-work policies and programs, hearing from state policymakers regarding successes and challenges around stay-at-work, return-to-work, including the retaining Employment and Talent After Injury Illness Network, also known as RETAIN Initiative. Hearing from people who have participated in and benefited from stay-at-work, return-to-work initiatives, which provided an understanding of their challenges and experiences. Connecting and working with other members of our state team to strengthen relationships and identify opportunities for future collaboration. Developing an action plan for improving stay-at-work, return-to-work policies and programs for our state. So, Mr. Chairman, at the end of our forum, and you were there, as mentioned, our task was to draft a bill which included a return-to-work, stay-at-work coordinator and a plan to assist employers and employees to return to the workforce. Thus, Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 206, Workers' Compensation Stay-at-Work Program. Each year, countless workers face the challenges of injuries, illnesses, or changes in their disability status, often leading to significant time away from work. This not only affects their livelihoods, but it also impacts the workforce and economy at large. Senate Bill 206, which would establish the Stay-at-Work and Return-to-Work Program, seeks to restore Alaska's once strong and healthy workforce. Through the creation of this program, an injured worker may elect assistance to return to work with their employer at the time of injury. The program is optional, though, and it can be declined by a worker or an employer. These programs focus on strategies that retain or re-engage workers experience such changes, aiming to swiftly reintegrate them into the workforce. By providing necessary support and resources, stay-at-work, return-to-work programs ensure that workers can continue their careers despite new health challenges, thereby maintaining a robust and resilient workforce. The goal of this program is to return the worker to the same position with the same employer or to a modified position with the same employer after an injury or an occupational disease occurs. Furthermore, services provided as part of the assistance program are provided in lieu of reemployment services. Changes under this bill would be optimized by the ability of the insurer, rehabilitation specialist, and the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to provide one another necessary information. For example, the Department of Labor shall advise insurer and employer the request for assistance. The services offered as part of the program are available as a service apart from the determination regarding indemnity benefits. Across the United States, states like Oregon and Montana, they have made significant strides in implementing stay-at-work, return-to-work initiatives. These programs have demonstrated success in reducing the time employees spend away from work due to disabilities or injuries, offering financial incentives, and facilitating necessary workplace adjustments. The adoption of similar legislation in Alaska promises substantial benefits. It can enhance our state's workforce stability, reduce the economic impact of prolonged employee absence, and promote a more inclusive and supportive work environment. So, Mr. Chairman, by passing this legislation, Alaska can join other states in leading the way towards a more adaptable and supportive workforce, ultimately benefiting both our economy and the well-being of Alaskan workers. Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, my staff can now go over the section analysis. Luma Diaz.
Thank you, ma'am. Ms. Diaz, please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Luma Diaz, staff to Senator Gray Jackson. I'm going to go ahead and read the sectional analysis for Senate Bill 206. Section 1 amends AS 2330005H by adding a reference to a new stay-at-work program under AS 2330043. Section 2 amends existing statute AS 2330041B by moving the annual reporting of the reemployment benefits from May until October to match the other annual reports due. Includes each a specific reporting criteria. Section 3 makes changes to AS 2330041C, adding 30 days to the time of required reemployment evaluations to allow for the medical stability of claimants. The amendments requires the Workers' Compensation Division to notify injured employees of right under the section within 25 days of inability to return to the employee's employment at the time of injury, including the option of participation in the stay-at-work program. Section 4 amends AS 2330041F by adding that an employee is not eligible for reemployment benefit if a selection under AS 2330-01C is not made, or if an employee has completed a stay-at-work program previously or had been found non-cooperative in the stay-at-work process under AS 2330-0431I. Section 5, a new section, Section 2330043, it's added to establish a stay-at-work benefit program. A new position is added as a subject matter expert to oversee the program. A rehabilitation specialist is assigned to develop a stay-at-work plan requiring participation and approval from the employee, employer, and attending physician at a timeline for submission for a plan. Costs are the responsibility of the employer and should not exceed $3,000. The maximum time frame is 2 years. Non-cooperation is defined. Participation is voluntary. The employee may pursue reemployment benefits under AS 2330041 as an alternative if the employer chooses not to participate. An appeal process is outlined. Section C6 amends existing statute AS 2330100A by adjusting the time frame by 15 days for notification of a work-related injury or death. Section 7 amends AS 2330105A by adding a reference to a new stay-at-work program established under AS 2330043. And finally, Section 8 sets an effective date.
Very good. Are there any questions about the sectional or questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we'll call on Director Collins with the Division of Workers' Compensation for a presentation regarding this bill.
Once again, for the record, Director Charles Collins, Workers' Compensation Division of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. First, let me start by thanking Senator Gray Jackson for bringing this much-needed program to the state of Alaska through Senate Bill 206. As we discussed earlier, currently we have a rehabilitation process under workers' compensation when a worker becomes injured that provides for benefits, and of course, workers' compensation always provides for medical benefits for injured workers as needed. However, occasionally, and maybe more than occasionally, those injured workers that are sitting on the sideline only need a little incentive to get back to work, maybe with the same employer, hopefully with the same employer, maybe even at the same job or a modified job. Most employers, when asked about modified jobs, the first thing they think about is how much it's going to cost them. Yet the average cost of a job modification is a few hundred dollars, believe it or not. And so very, in this day and age, considerable amount of technology is available to help people do the jobs that many of us do every day. And that modification can be a very easy thing. Our goal with Senate Bill 206 and this program for stay at work, return to work, was to shorten the time between the visit that an injured employee got and the rehabilitation specialists and our rehabilitation benefits administrator, so that we could communicate more fully the options that they may have. Many times people on the sideline that have been injured would like to be doing something, and we want to make sure that we get them back into work as soon as we can, because one of the things we heard most in Minneapolis last year, and I've heard it many times since in many of the follow-up meetings that I've had with people around the country, is that work is recovery. That people's entire lives revolve around what they do for work quite often. When you meet somebody new, what's the first thing they say to you? My name is Chuck, and I'm the director of workers' compensation. It's not all they do, but that's how we identify each other. And so when we take away that identification and it becomes my name is Chuck and I'm an injured employee, it means nothing. And so we want to continue with that. Many of us, our friends, our social structures revolve around those that we work and spend a considerable amount of time with. And if we can keep those people in that workforce, that's a win not only for that injured employee, that employer, but the entire society. So what we did is we went through a process of seeing how quickly we could move from the current process, which takes, Miss Niwa is going to kill me here, but I think I was going to say 206 days, but she did write it down for me. 205 days currently is the average time it takes for us to get somebody that's injured back for an extended amount of time through the process and back to work. And we think we can cut that down to 49 days. So we cut almost half a year off of the time that somebody could possibly be doing something productive in the workplace. Now, how do we do this? So we realize right now the biggest problem is communication. There's limited bandwidth of what happens. So let me take you through a scenario of what normally happens when somebody is injured at work. Now, when you work for a small employer or a big employer, it hardly matters, but Alaska's full of small employers. Those employees are like brothers, sisters, sons, cousins, you know, they're very close to you. And so when they're injured, of course you're concerned. They get the injury medically seen to, and you're checking on them as they recover. So that first week, you're with them every day. The second week, you call them a couple of times to make sure they're okay. The third week, maybe toward that end of that week, you're calling, hey, how's recovery going? The fourth week, you're busy. You're back doing it. When you're a business owner, you have other things that you're concerned about. You're concerned about the missing production of that worker. You're concerned about making numbers that week. It might be tax season. It might be inventory time. It might be anything. And so you might go a while. Sure, in another week or so, you might call them. So what happens is when an injured employee is out of work for 4 or 5 weeks, all of a sudden that communication gets slower, longer, much more deep. Uncommunicable. And the only person, quite often, an injured worker after about 6 or 8 weeks will hear from is the adjuster, the insurance adjuster, whose job it is to make sure that the benefits are going right and everything is. But we all know insurance adjusters also have their job that they're doing. Okay, are we doing everything properly? Or do we have this? And that might be a very fast phone call. And so this injured employee now is out there on their own. We want to bring that communication back. And that means that the department would step in and we would become that center of communication at that time. After about, we think within 20 days or so that we could step in there and we can communicate. So we need somebody that can not only communicate with the employer, communicate with the injured employee, but also might have to be communicating with the physicians, medical practitioners of some sort, and it has to be that person that has the bandwidth and the knowledge to be able to bring all of that together and convince an employer, hey, we can do a job modification here and we can get that person back to work for you. We can convince that employee that they can be productive at the job of their same employer, and that we can also speak to the doctor about what is the capacity this injured employee can do. And so we feel like that with this information that we could put a plan together and a process so that instead of employees being sidelined and maybe out of work for 90 days, 120 days, 180 days a year, that we can get them back into the workforce and being productive for us. With this bill, we have made it a voluntary process so that employers and employees might be able to work out something. Our incentive here is that we are merely adding the communication piece from the department in here. And the intent is to get the injured employee back on the job as quickly and safely as possible with a minimum cost to the employer. That's why we've limited the cost to the employer, because it's no incentive to an employer if they have to pay too much money for the production. But if they can bring back a trained, known entity as an employee, then they can get into there. So, but we also had to make it, you know, a voluntary program, because we can't dictate to the employer how they run their business, and far be it from my division to ever do anything like that. So with this plan and certainly the impetus that we have learned both at the meeting and with the Council of State Governments and the continuing work that the division has done with some of our subject matter experts around the country, we feel like that we can make an impact. Will this take away the entire rehabilitation process under 2330-041? No, because there's going to be some employees that are injured bad enough that they cannot, you know, they're not going to be able to participate. There's going to be some employers that just are not able to modify a job. You know, if that job happens to be carrying shingles up a ladder onto a roof, there may not be a modification for it. But we feel like that there's enough impact here that we can get people back to work. We can make an impact on them. And even if it's only 100 people a year, that's 100 people, the jobs that we've saved in the state. So that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Director Collins. Are there any questions for Director Collins or the bill sponsor? Seeing none, Ms. Niwa is also online for questions. At this time, I'll open up public testimony on Senate Bill 206. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify to Senate Bill 206? Is there anyone online wishing to testify to Senate Bill 206? Seeing none, we will leave public testimony open on Senate Bill 206. And I'll wrap up our talks of this bill with a few comments of my own. The meetings that Senator Gray Jackson and Director Collins, as well as Dwayne Mays and others from the Department of Labor, including Ms. Stacey Niwa, attended, were very valuable. Probably some of the most valuable, you could call it a field trip meeting, that I've had as a legislator. Producing this piece of legislation and then hopefully its implementation will yield fruit that is going to result in many Alaskans returning to work or being able to stay on the job after being injured. And for a topic like workers' compensation that might seem pretty boring and mundane to people who have not been hurt at work and missed work, it really became apparent to me that we needed to do something to create some change here, because Alaska's results in regards to workers' compensation and returning to work were not good. And so we clearly have some space to do better. And I believe that through this legislation, we are going to be able to do better. So thank you, Director Collins, for your leadership on this. Thank you, Senator Ray Jackson, for bringing this bill forward. And look forward to hearing it again soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
We'll set this bill aside for further consideration. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for our next bill.
This is a novel concept. It's something that is picking up steam across the country. And I look forward to answering any questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Here also with us is staff to the bill sponsor, Hunter Lotsfeld. Mr. Lotsfeld, please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, committee. My name is Hunter Lotsfeld, staff to Senator Wilikowski, and I'll start by going through our little presentation we have here. So SB 135, or the Alaska Work and Save Program. What is this? So this bill is an auto IRA program similar to what a lot of other states are doing. And to do it, it establishes the Alaska Retirement Savings Board, which would administer, set up the regulations for the program and then administer it. And then another novel part of our bill is that it would allow PFD checks to go towards that retirement savings account. So it'd be similar to like a pick, click, give option. So retirement in Alaska, over half of Americans do not have retirement savings. And as we know in Alaska, our aging population is growing and our young workforce is leaving us. It's just a fact. Our population's aging and we're not doing enough to save for retirement. There's a recent survey of small businesses here in Alaska. 64% of them reported not offering any sort of retirement plan, yet 70% of those respondents did say that they support a program similar to what we are proposing here. So what would SB 135 do? It would create the board. This board would be responsible for establishing and running the program. It would create the appropriate rules that would be in compliance with the IRS tax code. And then the board would also have the discretion on how to administer the program, whether it's setting up our own program or partnering with another state or maybe integrating into any of the previous, like the our previous saving programs, such as the direct contribution program that we currently use for state employees. Program participants would be automatically enrolled into this retirement savings plan. They could at any time decide to opt out or to adjust their contribution rate within that IRS minimum and maximum contribution rate. And they'd also be able to contribute their PFD towards their retirement. So the current costs for small business to operate a 401k plan, a recent survey of 121 plans with less than $2 million in assets. So that's, you know, a small-ish business, typically. The provider fees varied from $4,800 to over $17,000 per year, and that's not including the investment fees for these plans. So it can be quite costly for a small business to operate their own plan. Setting up a retirement plan, also, you don't necessarily need to use a plan provider. So you could save on those provider fees if you, a small business decided to do it themselves. But to do so, they would have to follow all the IRS guidelines. And to set up their own plan, they would have to create all the rules and regulations for that plan. They would have to have a trustee that acts as the fiduciary for that plan. And they would be in charge of handling all the contributions to the plan, the investments and distributions of that plan. They also have to have records, so not only of those contributions, investments, and distributions, but also of changes to the plan structure, and then also the IRS forms of the 5500 form, and then also any distributions would be a 1099 form. And then they're also responsible for keeping all their employees apprised of that plan. But then beyond just that, there's the operation of such a plan, and that varies depending on what kind of retirement plan we're talking about. But there is the question of vesting on these plans, and also annual anti-discrimination testing for 401k plans. So if you have over 100 people in your 401k, you have to do an annual test to make sure that you are not advantaging people higher up in your business than people lower down, essentially is what that means. So SB 135 is really here to both address the retirement issue, but also to support small businesses in offering these plans. As you've probably seen, we're on the 11th year of out-migration of working-age Alaskans. And these plans are both a lot of paperwork and bureaucracy, but they're also costly. And we think SB 114 will help small businesses to recruit and retain talent, and also stay competitive with larger businesses that are able to offer these plans or are already offering these plans. Other states have already started this. So as far as auto IRA programs go, there's 16 other states that are doing this. Similar federal legislation has been proposed, but it hasn't really gone anywhere. And other states are actually offering these interstate partnerships. So we have invited testimony from Hunter Raley, who's the director of the Secure Savings Program in Colorado. And Colorado is one of these states that has allowed other states to join into their plans to essentially create a larger pool of assets and savers, and thus to lower fees even more. So I believe Colorado is with Delaware. Delaware and Maine joined the Colorado program.
Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Wilikowski, for bringing this bill forward. But my question is just to make sure that I have a clear understanding of what the bill does. I think you do, but correct me if I'm wrong. So right now, municipality of Anchorage and state, they have plans, deferred comp. Okay, I'll use that as an example. And you make a contribution. The state makes a contribution too. So is this setting up something similar to that for small businesses?
Goodness, Chair. Bill Wilikowski. Thank you for the question. This would only apply to small businesses that don't, or to businesses that don't currently offer a retirement plan. So it wouldn't apply to the state. It wouldn't apply to any large organizations that currently do. And it essentially, it is a mandate, and I will say that up front. It's the softest of mandates possible, in that it says to small businesses, we will provide the infrastructure, we will provide the fiduciary responsibility, we'll pay the costs. You just have to sign up. You have to give your employees a sheet of paper to fill out and say that you are now participating in this plan. Now, what happens is there's a percentage that's deducted from the employee's paycheck. The employers, there's no contribution from employers. I'll be very clear about that. And so this will not cost employers. They will not be paying anything additional to do this. And so what would happen is, let's say an employee makes $500 in a week, a certain percentage, I think it's 5%, would be deducted from their paycheck and then go into this program, which can either be set up as a 401k, a taxable plan, or a non-taxable plan. That's up for the trustees to decide how they want to structure it. Most states tend to do a sort of a Roth, which is a non-taxable, non-taxable. It's kind of a savings plan. And then the employee at any time can opt out. The employee at any time can say, I don't want to be a part of this. I wish to opt out. The employee can also say, I wish to contribute more. They can contribute more up to the IRS guideline limits. And so it is making it easier for employees to set up these plans. It's making it easier for employers to offer these plans. But employees are free to opt out anytime they want.
If I can follow up, Mr. Chairman.
You may.
Thank you for that explanation. And based on what you said, I do have a clear understanding. And I know it's only for small businesses, but I'm clear on what it's going to do. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So two questions based on that response. So Is it only for small businesses, or are there some larger businesses that might not offer retirement that would fall into this, or are they already subject to some other kind of requirement? And the second question is about the you mentioned these sort of interstate pooling efforts led by Colorado and maybe others. Does this bill do we need this bill to do that in order to do that? Could we instead just sort of join Colorado's rather than setting up our own board? Or do we need to have sort of the internal infrastructure before we join? And the final question is, I presumably it'd be the board that makes a decision about whether to join or not join. So I just wonder if you could answer those.
Yeah, great. Thank you for the question, Senator, through the chair. I keep referring to small businesses, because small businesses tend to be the ones that don't offer any retirement plans. It actually applies to all employers in the state. It is just so happens that the vast majority that don't offer retirement are small businesses. So it is open to all. And what it would say on page three, an employer that does not offer a qualified retirement plan. So it's all employers. That's number one. As far as participation with other states, I think you do need the structure in place in order to be able to participate with other states. And it's just, and let me state this, anyone can go out, any employee right now can go out and set up a 401k, can set up a Roth account, can set up the non-Roth, anybody can do that. The problem is that we know statistically the vast majority of people don't do that. And so this is sort of a way of encouraging people to do it, getting them started on that path towards savings. The statistics again show that once people start this, they don't even see it, you know, coming off their paycheck. And then before they know it, they have a fairly decent amount of savings. And then so to coordinate with the other states to lower the fees, yeah, that would require legislation to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Lotzfeldt.
If I could add something to the chair, Senator Dunbar. The interstate partnership would also, we would still need to have our own board, but the interstate partnership would also allow us to enact such a program much faster. I think it took Maine and Delaware like a year to get their program up and going. So I think the ability to share some resources that have already been established by Colorado, if we were to join that state, would ease the burden on us, essentially.
Very good. Any further questions for the bill sponsor or Mr. Lotzfeldt? Seeing none, we'll move now to invited testimony. Up first, we have Jennifer Sauer, Senior Research Advisor for the Financial Resilience Research Arm of AARP. Ms. Sauer.
Hi, good afternoon. I do have a very brief presentation, but I'm not sure if you have the slides or if you need me to share my screen. Or if you have the document.
We have the slides and the documents. So okay. When you need to advance in your presentation, ma'am, if you could just say next okay. slide, and sure. We can do that here.
All right. So if you want to go right to slide two, second slide, we can start there. And here you'll see, it's just a quick snapshot of the business owners that we surveyed. And I'll let you look at this info a little bit while I just give you some information about the methodology. The survey was conducted by phone, both via landline and cell phone, and we offered the option to complete it online if a business could not connect by phone. So we essentially sent a text to go to a website. And for the research types in the room, the margin of error was 4.85%. So if you want to go to the next slide. And then the next slide, the survey result. So well over half of all small business owners in Alaska are concerned that their employees will not have enough money to cover healthcare or living expenses through their retirement years, with one in four saying they are very concerned. And interestingly, another one in four say they are not at all concerned. Next slide. Moreover, three in four small business owners expressed concern that some Alaska residents have not saved up enough for retirement and could end up being reliant on state-funded public assistance programs, with close to four in 10 saying they are very concerned. Next slide. In fact, 3/4 most of the small business owners would like more to be done to help encourage Alaskans safer retirement, with half saying a lot more needs to be done. So you can go to the next slide. So now we're going to go take a look at just how important retirement savings for workers are to small business owners in Alaska. Next slide. So first, we need to get an idea of who among small business owners in Alaska actually offer a retirement savings plan to their employees. Our survey yielded just 1/3 saying they do indeed offer a retirement savings plan to their employees, while most do not. Next slide. And when asked, when we asked small business owners to tell us in their own words why they do offer a retirement savings plan to employees, among many reasons, attracting and retaining quality employees was a top reason, followed by it's just the right thing to do. Next slide. Now let's turn to the larger group of small business owners who are not offering workers a way to save for retirement. Among the nearly 2/3 of Alaska small business owners who do not offer their employees a way to save for retirement, the cost of operating a retirement savings plan is the top reason. Followed by, for some, the plans could be too complicated to operate, or they can just be too time-consuming to operate. Next slide. And then when asked outright if they agree or disagree that being able to offer a voluntary, portable retirement savings program that would help local small businesses attract and retain quality employees and stay competitive, the majority of all small business owners in the survey agreed, with almost half saying they strongly agree. Next slide. So what do Alaska small business owners think about a public-private Alaska retirement savings option? Next slide. After describing the proposed savings program to them, well over 2/3 of all Alaska small business owners say they would support a public-private partnership to develop an easy, no-cost retirement savings program for small business owners in the state. And next slide. And then after providing them with additional context about the state retirement savings option, such as no employer fees, no employer match, and no employer fiduciary responsibility, more small business owners show support for it, with almost half saying they strongly support it. And next slide. So based on the research, there appears to be strong interest and support for a legislative solution among small business owners in Alaska. Almost 8 in 10 agree that state legislators should support a bill to make it easier for small business owners to access a retirement savings option for their employees, with nearly half saying they strongly agree. And next slide, that's the last slide, and that's all I have. Any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Sauer. Are there questions for Ms. Sauer? We appreciate that data, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Sure. Yep, my pleasure.
We'll go to our next testifier, Hunter Raley, Director, Colorado Secure Savings Program. Mr. Raley, please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Hunter Raley, Executive Director of the Colorado Secure Savings Program. I'm here to highlight some of the benefits of state auto IRA programs similar to what's being proposed in SB 135. As director of the Colorado program, I work to ensure Colorado employees have the opportunity to achieve a dignified and sustainable retirement. It's clear from the data nationally that far too many people lack access to a retirement plan at work, and that accessing a plan at work makes it more likely for workers to save. In Colorado, our research indicated that nearly 1 million workers lacked access to a workplace retirement account. These programs help create an environment where small businesses who cannot afford to offer retirement plans otherwise can compete with larger employers. It also improves worker well-being for everyone. Prior to passing the Secure Savings Program into law, our office conducted an extensive study on the impact of the retirement savings gap. The results showed that the cost of doing nothing in addressing this gap would cost taxpayers $18 billion over the next 15 years. Similar estimates have been done at the federal level that this retirement savings gap could cost taxpayers up to $1.3 trillion. The biggest barriers that were identified to offering that this, as have been noted here, are that cost and complexity of administration for employers. We designed our program to meet these needs. Our onboarding process for employers takes about 15 minutes, and ongoing administration for employers is about 5 minutes per month, if that. And the program is provided at no cost to employers. This is crucial because business owners are already busy, and allows the program to be an asset rather than a burden. The proof is in the results. Nationally, Sabres have accumulated nearly $1.5 billion in assets in just 6 reporting states. In Colorado alone, over 14,000 employers have helped their employees save nearly $40 million in our first full year of operation. To also highlight a point, too, of how these programs sort of support private actors in this market, a private payroll provider, Gusto, estimated that Colorado saw a 45% increase in private plan adoption in the first year of implementation correlated to our required program being enrolled. Also, part of our design, we understood that there would be limitations for some states if they attempted to implement this. As was noted, Colorado has created access to a multi-state partnership model that makes the program more accessible to smaller population states. It also helps reduce your expenses and your timeline to implementation. We're currently the only state facilitating a multi-state partnership, as was noted with Maine and Delaware, and we're currently speaking to several others. And I think the biggest piece to flag here is that our model prioritizes collaboration and the autonomy of partner states to meet saver needs within a proven program structure. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions the committee might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Raley. Seeing no questions, we'll move on to our next test fire. Thank you again for your presentation, sir. Up next is Colorado Treasurer Dave Young. Mr. Young.
Treasurer Young, I apologize. Treasurer Young got looped into a meeting, so he was unable. I'm speaking on his behalf.
Oh, very good. Well, hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate that. Senator Wilkowski, Mr. Lotzfeld, did you have any other invited testifiers? Okay. I have one question. We do have a couple of folks from the administration, Genevieve Wostuk from Permanent Fund and Pam Leary from DOR available for questions. I have a question for Ms. Leary. DOR has delivered an indeterminate fiscal note for this bill. My question is, if we were to join a system of other states like what Colorado has available, what impact would that have on a fiscal note from your department, ma'am?
Hi, this is Pam Leary. I am the director of the Treasury Division in the Department of Revenue. And yes, it was difficult to identify what the costs might be of a program like this. I am familiar with 3 different types of programs. One, the Alaska Retirement Management Board oversees some of the deferred comp and defined contribution plans, which are 401k-like investments. So something similar to that could be implemented. I'm also familiar with like the College 529 Savings Plans, which is a standalone division working just for Alaska with staff. And I'm also familiar with the 529A or ABLE programs, which are similar to college savings programs, but for people with disabilities. And that is housed within our division, and we joined 16 other states and have one record keeper and vendor who runs the program. So I think there are a variety of ways costs, the program could be implemented and associated costs would be. The program with ABLE is now fairly well mature in that it's the participants pay for most of the cost of their investments. And the contributing states Some of them have a group of individuals that run the program in larger states. And for us, it's really just done within our department. So the costs have been minimized. We did have some upfront costs for that program, and we share costs with the Council on Disabilities for some ongoing marketing efforts. So there's a variety of ways that this can be implemented, and what those costs could be will be based on whatever structure is formatted and followed.
I appreciate that information, ma'am. If we were to join a system like Colorado's, based on that system and our ability to join it, could you give us an idea and get back to the committee about what those specific costs might be?
I would be happy to reach out to Colorado and investigate what that might be.
Thank you, ma'am.
Back to the committee. Yep.
Other questions? Okay. At this time, we will open public testimony on Senate Bill 135. We have a couple of folks online wishing to testify. First, we will go to Girdwood and Louis Theis.
Hello, this is Lou. Can you hear me?
We got you.
Okay. I've been retired for 11 years, and I have decades of liquidity ahead, thanks to automatic payroll deductions for Social Security, a pension, and later on a 401k. Now, during that time, during my 40 years of saving for retirement, I only had two employers. But things have changed a lot. Some of these options are no longer available. I worked for, you know, big companies, and I stuck with two of them. So it was very simple. But my son, you know, he works in the ski town here in Girdwood, and he's worked retail, restaurants, all the tourist trade operations. He gets multiple W-2s every year, and in the 10 years he's been here working, no one has ever offered him a retirement plan. And I think Work and Save is perfect for him. And you know, I know that there's always misgivings about anything that's mandatory, but you know, when I look at his multiple W-2s, I think, wow, that's the reason that this mandatory thing is there. And so the thing that Work and Save has is that it's got the most important elements for successful retirement savings, and that's portability and payroll deduction. Most retirement advice that we hear starts with what matters most is regular savings, dollar cost averaging no matter what. I think SB 135 can do that. And plus, it seems to have the simplicity of Occam's razor. And I think it's something that we got to do. And so if there's no questions, I'm done with my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, Marge Stone King.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Marge Stone King. I am the Director of Advocacy for AARP Alaska. And AARP is a nonpartisan, nonprofit member organization serving the 50-plus population. Our purpose is to empower people to be able to choose how they live as they age. And retirement readiness is a big part of having choices for how one lives in retirement. However, nearly 60% of American households have no assets saved for retirement. And while protecting Social Security is an AARP top federal priority and a critical piece of the puzzle, it is not enough to depend on for retirement readiness. Without access to a retirement savings plan at work, nearly all workers fail to save. Only 5% of people actually save for retirement if an employer plan doesn't cover them and they have to go out and seek it on their own. But people are 15 times more likely to save for retirement if they have access to a way to do so at work, and 20 more times more likely to if they are automatically enrolled in that workplace savings option. Nearly half of Alaska private sector workers, and certainly more of those we heard from in the survey, don't have access to a way to save from their regular paycheck at work for retirement. And as you know, the smaller the businesses, the less likely they are to be able to offer retirement savings plans to their staff, given the hurdles that the bill sponsor outlined. Almost 73% of workers at Alaska businesses with under 10 employees and 66% at companies with between 10 and 24 employees don't have the ability to offer a plan, which is why AARP strongly supports the creation of a public-private retirement savings partnership that allows Alaska workers to save their own money for the future. Work and Save legislation could change the landscape on retirement readiness in Alaska by giving businesses an easy, no-cost retirement option for employees. Alaska Work and Save would be a state-facilitated retirement savings option that the public-private partnership, working similar to the College 529 plan or the ABLE accounts, as mentioned earlier. The state serves the role of registering businesses and has run oversight of the program, while a private sector financial services provider manages and runs the investment. All businesses would have to do is register with the state and pass information on from the program to their employees and add a payroll deduction to their employee paycheck with zero employer fees, zero match, and no liability. A worker owns their own savings account. It's portable. They can take it from job to job, or rather it follows them, while saving as much as they choose through payroll deduction. And employee accounts are voluntary. They can opt out at any time. Participating employers would not be responsible for workers' savings gains or losses. And again, no employer match. So Work and Save will help small businesses compete with larger employers' benefit packages, enabling them to better hire and keep valued employees, as well as help Alaskan workers become financially self-sufficient in retirement. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Stone King. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify to Senate Bill 135? Anyone else online would like to state for the record that Senator Merrick joined us at about 2:55 p.m. Welcome, Senator Merrick. Let's see. I have a question for the bill sponsor, Senator Wilkowski. So just so I have this clear in my mind, all W-2 employees would be eligible for this plan as part of the mandate, but upon hire, they would receive a form that would allow them to opt out if they so choose. Is that true?
That's through the chair. To the chair, Bill Wilkowski. Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very good. And so, as I read the bill and hear the testimony with options for implementation, do you have a preference as far as outlined in any of the fiscal notes or what we've heard so far?
I think ultimately, Mr. Chairman, I think ultimately the goal is to have this as a low to no cost for the state of Alaska as possible. Ideally, what would happen is this: in my mind, the state would evaluate the cost to run one of these plans, and then they would charge a fee, and then that fee would cover the cost of the plan, the administration. And my understanding is that some states have as high as 1%. Some states, I believe Colorado's about 35.35%, so 35 basis points, which is, I think, fairly competitive. And so if you can do it with another state, you can keep the cost very low to the state. You can keep the cost low to the employee as well, and they can make more money for their investments. So I think with a small pool that we have in Alaska, it probably is beneficial for us to work with other states to do this. Or one other state at least.
Very good. And working with another state, would we need our own board then?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we can try to figure out that, but I think you need a board in place that is going to set a broad framework, because otherwise it's left to the legislature. You need someone to go ahead and administer the plan, someone to set the basic framework, someone to decide that we should or should not work with other states. So I think you do need some sort of board in place to administer this. And I agree. I don't, I want to keep this as small and low cost to government as possible. I just think you need some sort of basic framework. We could either establish that legislatively, but I think there are some details that probably just need to be worked out by professionals.
Understood. Thank you. Any further questions for the bill sponsor or anyone else? Seeing none, we'll set this bill aside for further consideration. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Friday, February 16th, when we will hear Senate Bill 134, Senate Bill 166, and Senate Bill 191. As there is no further business before Senate Labor and Commerce today, this meeting is adjourned at 3:02.